Welcome back, one and all. This is the Game Dev Show. My name is Luke Greenaway, and today I am joined by the wonderful Amber Leisure. Is that correct?
Leisure,
your accent's fantastic. Mine is disappointing at best.
No. English accent is just so beautiful.
Amber, Director of Operations at EA Motive. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, please. Pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Whereabouts are you based?
I'm in Montreal. Fantastic. So I'm originally from France. I'm French. And I moved to Montreal more than 15 years ago.
Why?
I used to travel a lot with my parents. We visited a lot of countries and we came twice to Canada and I fell in love with the landscape and the people. I had no idea when I was young what I wanted to do in my life. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to study there. Looks cool. And I chose actually a school that has Montreal in the name. I went to HEC Montreal and HEC is actually a big school in France. So I say, oh, so my parents are going to say yes if there is HEC in the title and there is Montreal. Let's go there.
That's fantastic. I mean, like, yeah, Canada is stunning and it's fantastic for the games industry as well. I think what Canada have done with incentivizing investment within the games industry is brilliant. And it's kind of like almost a case study of how governments should approach our industry. But yeah, like I wanted to talk to you about growing up because you studied business administration in IT before ergonomics and UX focused on games at Polytechnic in Montreal. I'm obviously checking all my pronunciations. Thank you. Was the intention always to have a career in games?
Not at all. I've always been interested in entertainment in general. So I chose HEC because it was broad enough for me to give me enough opportunities. And then when choosing the specialization, I went into IT because since I was young, I always had computers around me and I always liked anything that is tech. My brother used to teach me how to do some websites and stuff like that. So that's really something that was interesting for me. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I went there because I was attracted to it. And then I had the possibility to either stay in HEC to do something in BI. And I thought I should change just to see other people and see other way of working. So I went to Polytechnic and I discovered the world of cognitive ergonomics. So the way that the human brain treats the information, it's now UX, it's applied to UX in the video games. And when I started my master thesis, that I never finished, by the way, at Poly, I entered at the same time at Ubisoft as an intern. The way I started as an intern was really not a lucky, but I went to an event in Montreal called the MIGS, the Montreal International Game Summit. And I went there with a friend. I was not planning on applying or anything, but in discussions with recruiters, I was explaining what I was studying, what was my background, and they told me, oh, so maybe we have an internship that could be interesting for you. So even if I was not planning to get a job, I still came prepared. I got my resume there. So I just gave them my resume. And they called me back. I did some interviews. And I think it was 2 or 3 weeks after that they confirmed that I got the job, the internship. That's how I started in game.
That's mad. That's great. Do you ever regret not finishing your master's?
No. I mean, personally, I'm like, oh, I was so close, but it's not really, once you're in the video game industry, it's not really useful. I guess, depending on what you're doing. But with the job that I have, I don't need to have a master's thesis. And we have people that don't even have a bachelor, and that's okay. It's more what you're doing and what you're bringing to the table than the diploma that you have.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important, that message, because I think the industry is so young. And from my experience, it's passion, you know, wants to create and create the best possible games. And I think that goes a lot further than certain degrees. Not all degrees. I mean, we have a lot of people who have been on the show and they've got like computer science degrees and that's really helped them. Would you say your education has helped you within the games industry?
So it helped me getting in the game industry because of what I just told you, the internship that I managed to get. I think then once you're in it, it's more the way that you adapt to situation, the way that you learn. And maybe you're going to need at one point, I don't know, if you know nothing about programming and you want to be a programmer, for sure you need to go and get a degree or at least some knowledge about it because you can't just learn on the fly programming. But I think it's also a question of how do you do learn on the job? And most companies also have trainings on site that you can actually get. The only part that I think was really helpful for me was anything linked to data analysts. So I started as a data analyst. The way that it works is that most of games right now, they have ways to know were people that in the game, did they use this specific feature or not? So it's not to track the specific person, like we know that Luke died there. It's just to be able to understand how they use the games and then how you can improve for the next game. This, because of the IT background that I had, I was able to understand databases, to be able to query with the cognitive ergonomics, to be able to understand, okay, so maybe that's the way that people saw that the way it was presented to them in the game. So that's why they went that way instead of that way. And so there was, at the beginning, a good mix of this. And then I kept the data analysis on the management side to do dashboards, reporting, and to be able to know how we can get better at what we're doing, mainly in terms of business.
That's really interesting. It's almost like the early stages of qualitative testing, but actually using data to support your findings. And so therefore you can identify trends. And eventually, I suppose the aim is to lead to better game design and level design and features and so on. Was there anything you ever discovered and you were like, wow, didn't expect that? Like, why is everybody doing that? Or do those moments always happen?
There was a moment in one game that the way, I think it was one of the Prince of Persia, it was supposed to be open. So you have three choices. And everyone would thought that because there were three choices, you would see like a third of people going with this on the first, etc., and the third on the middle and third. And what we saw is that most of people, they started from the left and then they went on the right. And it was mainly when you know the way that people are reading, because you start usually from the left and then you go to the right. And it was, and then once you have the data to back that up, then the game designers are like, oh yeah, well, that makes sense. So it's interesting to see what you were planning on doing in terms of your intention, in terms of design, and then the way it's actually used in the game.
Then what happens? So say you're picking a class in a game and on the left you have warrior, in the middle you have a wizard, and on the right you have a rogue. Does that mean naturally, subconsciously, people, if they go in no preconceptions and no prejudices, they're more likely to pick the warrior on the left than the other two classes?
So I guess it would depend. In that specific case that I was talking about, there were no distinction. You would see three paths, but there was no like, this is clearly a warrior, this is clearly a wizard. Because then you add the notion of preference in terms of, well, maybe I don't like warriors and I prefer being a wizard. But so, yeah, it really depends on the different elements that you give in terms of for the player to know. If it's just simply a list or three choices that more or less look the same, then maybe you won't see the effect that you're looking for.
I always wonder in games where you have a list of classes, whether people who are new to the game just pick the top one. And that skews the statistics because they're like, I'm just going to go with the first one. Like, because naturally people do that subconsciously throughout their lives.
I guess it will depend also on the visual that you have with this person, even regardless, if you know nothing about the classes and what they do, maybe you're just like, this one looks way cooler than the others.
Yeah. I'm going to go with this one. It's mad, isn't it? You could go so deep on this. We could go into like a rabbit hole of data. And you know, when you have a lot of data, access to a lot of data, and you start identifying trends, does that then manipulate your decisions? Because you're like, well, I can see the data. So for example, if you want to play the least played class, like, you know, you want to stand out in a game, you're never going to know that unless you see the data. And then you find the data, and it says, okay, you know, priest is the least played class. You then choose priest, and it manipulates your entire decision-making process based on data that you've been shown. Is that something that can happen with game design and game creation?
Well, game designers now, they have so many data and they can analyze it in so many ways that I think it's more, once we give that to the players, it would be interesting to see, would they change their habits in terms of playing if they knew that many people? Maybe. And that's where it's interesting also with anything that is user-generated content, because they have almost all the tools that they need, and then they can give all the stats to the players and play with it. They can be their own game designers and use the game to do this. I'm pretty sure some people would be, if they knew for sure, maybe they will change the way that they play.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? I think it's fascinating. I've got to ask you that, like, you obviously mentioned your first role at Ubi through the internship, which is fantastic. But you're actually at Ubi for 9 years and you had
almost 10, yeah.
The first was as the in-game data analyst, but you had like several other roles during this period. Like, could you, I know it's quite a large question, but could you talk us through those positions and just like what you learn and just your journey for those 10 years?
Sure. It's funny when someone says 10 years is a lot. In my head, I'm still at the beginning of my career. So much years to go. So I started as an intern. I think the internship was 6 months, and then I switched to a full-time job. But after a few months, the team that I was in was closed and went to someone else, another business unit inside UB. So that's where I had the choice to make, to either go into the game design side, because of the data analysis, I had to touch some game design. And that's something that I wish I had studied, at least to be able to have notions of game design. So it was either that or management, because I studied at business schools. So I decided to go on the dark side of the force, and I was on the management side, but still with the data analysis part. So it was at the, you know, when Facebook started and everyone had game on Facebook. Well, Assassin's Creed was on Facebook. Part of my job was to analyze the way that players were actually using the game. So I was doing some coordination, making sure that everyone is the team of everything that they need in terms of logistics, ordering food if they needed food, making sure that we have clear goals and know where we were at, etc. So it was a mix of data analysis and management. And then when we started, I think it was Revolution at the time, they came to get me to be fully coordinator and stop the data analysis and mainly do the coordination on the project. So being a production coordinator is actually the entry level in terms of management. But it was really interesting because you interact with everyone on the production, because everyone at one point needs either a computer or software or food. So you have to interact with them, and the community is so open that you can ask questions on, oh, so what are you doing and who are you interacting with? So you know everyone on the floor and you know how they interact with each other and how you start from level design, but then you need some animation and programming. And then it goes from there to you have cinematics and you see the whole process and you can make link with each other. So that's an interesting view that you can have while starting in the video game industry. So that was really interesting for me. And because I love data, I started using data to do dashboards and stuff like that. So that's why also got me in the second part. So when we went into, after I think it was Black Flag, the idea for me was to put dashboards in place for everyone, but also to make sure that all around the world, everything was going well. So I was in charge of collaboration then, a switch role from production coordinator to production manager. The objective at the beginning was to spend a few weeks/month in each country. And at one point, I think we went with up to 9 or 10 studios. And I'm like, yeah, no, it's just, I love traveling. Wow. But when you're traveling for work, this is definitely not fun. You can't just travel and say, oh, this is beautiful, I'm going to visit. You just, no.
The jet lag must have been horrific. Was that global? Were you like literally continent to continent?
That was at the beginning, it was just Singapore and Montreal. And then we extended to more studio. But I remember one day I had, because we were also doing an analysis on another game. So I went from Montreal to Sweden. I did a pit stop in, because every time I travel, I try to stop in Paris to see my parents. So weekend in Paris, then Sweden, and then from Sweden to China. Then I'm like in China, I'm going to go to Singapore, see my colleagues. So I went to Singapore, went back to Sofia, and then I went back for Christmas at my parents. And I'm like, I don't know where I am. I don't know what time it is. So when you travel, pace yourself. But that was interesting because then you see all the different cultures. Because even if it was in the same company, seeing the way that things are handled in Singapore, for example, versus in Montreal, it's a complete other culture. And even just in Quebec, so there are studios in Quebec City and in Montreal, there is right there, even if it's the same province, same country. The idea for me, what's really interesting in collaboration is the way that you can grow from each other. So sometimes I went to, in Bulgaria and seeing the way that they were doing things, like, oh, maybe we should see how we can implement that in Montreal. And maybe we can also explain to them why we're doing things that way so that they understand also. So it was really a role for me of learning, but also translator, kind of process translator of, you know, when Montreal is asking you this question, it's because in the culture, in the Montreal culture, it's that way. So you have to take it that way, etc. And then coming back to Montreal, because the lead was in Montreal, then I had to explain, well, when someone in Singapore or Shanghai is asking you a question about this, that's because here is the context that you need to know. And so it was, for me, really enlightening in terms of human interaction, I would say. And the way that the context is key to understand everything.
Yeah, I guess that is like, it's one of the incredible things about the industry. And obviously working for such a big company is that you do get to interact with multiple cultures on projects. But it can be incredibly challenging. I'm lucky enough to work with several cultures every day. Being based in the UK, my boss is in California, but I'll work with like our president in China. I work with the team in Japan, and I find it incredibly fascinating and like enlightening how everyone approaches their roles differently. And even the way people think from like blue sky thinking to like pragmatism. It can be incredibly challenging, but it's incredibly enlightening. What was probably your most challenging role during your time at UB? Was there a point, obviously the traveling sounds awful, but was there a part and you were like, this is just going to get on top of me unless I do something? Did you have like a moment like that?
Overall, there are good and bad things. I mean, every job that you get, and sometimes it's, especially when you ship, you have so many on your plate that it can feel difficult. So at the end of Origins, we were finishing Origins. I was handling the educational mode from Origins. That's the first time that we remove all the violence and we work with teachers to have a mode that is actually usable and you can learn from it in terms of history. That was the best project, especially because it was a way for us to show that you can learn from video game and video games are not necessarily violent. And then you can just use that and teachers are using that. So we're doing this, and I was starting at that time Odyssey also. We had a team in Montreal and I was ending that. So I had three things at the same time. And after that, I'm like, yeah, no, I don't think that will happen. So I was really close to a burnout, if not already in a burnout, to be honest.
Oh, wow.
and then I realized during the Christmas break, I'm like, I think I need to slow down and to take care of myself. So when I came back, I told my boss, this is done. The next one, I think you need to find someone else. I'm going to go for a month sabbatical. And I went into sabbatical. So that's for me, it's not a bad thing. It's just that you know when you reach your limit and you need to be able to understand, okay, this is, I can't do more and I need to stop just for my own sake.
Yeah. I'm glad you got to that point and you were able to. Did your boss react like well, or were you scared before telling them?
I was so scared of telling him. but I knew at the same time, I knew he would understand. I don't think he saw it coming. That's something that we need really to work on in terms of, and that's not just for him, but any manager, it's being able to show those signs of people getting tired. And sometimes as a manager, we need to protect our employees, especially if we know that they can do a lot. Sometimes we have a tendency to take too much on our shoulders. So when I told him, he was surprised, but he totally understood. He's like, let me know what I can do. And then we'll make sure that it happens. You need to rest. So that was really, really glad to have someone like this. Yeah.
No, that's great. I think it's, what did you do with your time off? Did you do anything specific?
I traveled. I love traveling. So at that time, my brother was in New Caledonia, so right next to to Australia. So I went to see him, I think, for 3 weeks. And then I went for a month in France to help my parents. They just bought a house at that point. So I just helped renovating the house. Felt so good. Doing nothing with your brain, but just physical work. That was cool. And then spending time in Montreal, taking care. You know, we have usually when you work, there are so many things that you don't do. And then once you're on PTO, you're like, oh, I'm on the holidays, but I don't want to do this.
That sounds excellent. I mean, it's so much more productive than I would have been in that time off. I think I would have just put on weight and
every time I go to France, I put on weight. So for sure, I did.
The food. The food is fantastic. I mean, so following Ubi, you went to Reflektor and you were there for a year and as head of operations. What led to the move? Was there something specific happened and how was it at Reflektor?
So Reflektor Entertainment is a small company, an indie company. They don't do just video games. They do more than that. So movies, TV shows, books. And I told you earlier, I was always interested in entertainment, especially in the movie industry. So I thought this is a great way for me to see how it is. There is still the game part. So I know a bit at least of the industry on this part. And then I can learn on the rest. And it was almost 10 years at Ubisoft. I thought I needed also to see something else to be able to grow. So the same way that every time I shipped a game, I switched in terms of ownership and role. I wanted also to see, okay, let's see what's outside of a big company. So I went there. It was interesting. I started as a producer and then what they call an IP producer, so taking care of the whole IP, not only the video game, but also the movie and the TV show, the comics, etc. I actually miss games at the point. It's specific to this context. I thought that the way that the movie industry, and when I'm generalizing, but once again, I don't think I know the whole industry of movie industry, but I feel that we're more team players in video games than in movies. In movies, you know about the producers and the actors most of the time, but you don't know about all the VFX artists that are behind it, all the people that are doing the montage after that. So, and there are so many people involved in a movie that I felt that, and it's really, really silos and everything. And I remember the way that we're used to work on Assassin's Creed, and I thought, I'm a team player. I need to feel that there is no one person above the other. There is no ego. This is a team thing. And that's why when EA poked me, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm interested in getting back there for sure. And I mean, the title of being director of operation for me was also really interesting in terms of a career opportunity.
I think it's good though that you ventured out of games. Like you said, you're a fan of entertainment. And I think if you hadn't done that when you did, there could be the possibility that now you'd be sitting here like maybe a bit resentful of yourself that you hadn't actually tried something different. But yeah, and obviously EA came to you for this fantastic role. Tell me about this. So what did they do? Did they find you on LinkedIn and they were like, look, Amber?
In Montreal, there are lots of companies in Montreal, but it's kind of a big family. Many of us, we know each other. I guess some people work with me also in the past, maybe at Ubisoft. And funny enough, Reflector is a few floor downstairs. We're in the same building.
Mm. Is that awkward? Is it ever awkward?
That was definitely awkward for me. So yeah, I think it's a question of LinkedIn search, but also the people knowing each other. And then as you start working in games, people know each other. So your reputation will also make sure that you get people joining you, booking you.
Mm, yeah. I think, and obviously that's fantastic, isn't it? You know, if,
it was flattering. I'm like, oh
yeah, it is, isn't it? Like, you know, you're like, oh yeah, you remember me. Like,
but at the same time, so, and I guess we all have men or women, we all have an imposter syndrome. And that's where I'm like, really? Me? And I got the same, I mean, when you book me for this podcast, I'm like, really? Me? Why?
Oh, please.
And then you go into interviews and I mean, ultimately the thing that I learned through my beginning of career, not the whole career, is that I will never say no if I have nothing to lose. So if someone books me and especially at the time, because I knew that I wanted to go back to games, the door was already open. So I was like, yeah, sure. Why not discuss with them? Even if I think that maybe I'm not good for that job, I'll go there and I'll try. And
I think, you know what? I think that's a fantastic ethos, you know, like I'll never say no if I have nothing to lose. I think that's brilliant. Obviously, we've benefited because you said yes to coming on the show.
That brought me to an interesting situation. And so on one day on Assassin's Creed Origins, our game director couldn't go to an event in Las Vegas. So he's like, do you want to go there? I'm like, sure. So at the beginning, it was supposed to be someone arriving on a camel because it was set in Egypt. Okay. No, that's not happening. So like, okay, so we're going to downgrade it a bit and they're going to be an eagle coming to stage. So I was preparing. So I had to talk in front of, I think it was 5,000 people. So first there is this in English. I'm like, sure. What did I say? Yes. Okay, let's go. And then I was so scared because the idea was for the eagle to land on the actor's arm and then the actor would leave with the eagle and then I would arrive. And when we rehearsed the day before, the eagle did land on the arm and it was just circling around. I'm like, okay, you're gonna see that tomorrow. I'm gonna talk and then the bird is gonna poop on me and I'm like, So ultimately everything went well. I delivered everything. I even took a picture with the eagle. That was another me saying yes to things. Just like, what's happening?
I just imagine this eagle just carrying you away at the end.
Yeah.
It's interesting with imposter syndrome. Do you know, like, this is coming up in more and more conversations recently I'm having with my peers and just in general, right? I don't know if it's obviously it's not exclusive to the video games industry. I don't know if it's an age thing. I don't know if it's like a societal problem. Like, but I think imposter syndrome is like a real root of a lot of anxiety that people experience. Always feeling like they're never doing enough, I guess. I think it's a tough one. I think it's a real tough one. I should have asked Celia. So obviously, because you and Celia, I don't know how you know each other, but yes. I know you know. I should have actually asked Celia because she would have been the person to ask. I think, but
for sure. I think, and it was an interesting article in the Harvard Business Review recently. I don't think it's specific to women, but I think the way that our companies are sometimes not putting you can't really fail, or the way that they handle failures versus successes and wanting you to be perfect. Maybe that's what's adding on us. So depending, I mean, not all companies are like this. If you're in a team and in a company where they accept that you're making mistakes, maybe your imposter syndrome will be less. Because then you're like, yeah, sure, I'm human and I don't need to be perfect. It's as soon as you want to reach perfection, which I think ultimately many of us are, we know that it's not healthy, but we all are trying to be perfect. This is what is adding on us. But that would be interesting to have a Celia for sure point of view on that.
Yeah, and for those who obviously don't know who are listening, Celia Hoden and Amber, how do you, Celia, who was on, I think it'll be about 10 episodes ago now, who is a PhD in psychology, UX expert, UX consultant. How do you two know each other?
So she worked briefly in Ubisoft Montreal, and it was when I was still working on my master thesis, which was about cognitive ergonomics, and there was a part of psychology in it. Through a colleague, I managed to meet with her and to discuss it. She's really, really interesting. I mean, if you haven't listened to the podcast with Celia, go for it.
Thank you. That's a fantastic plug. Really appreciate that. Amber wasn't paid for that contribution anymore. Coming back to EA, so tell us about Motive.
Motive was created in 2015. I joined in 2019, a few months after, so the leadership changed, and now we have Patrick Klaus in charge of it. So that's when I joined. We've been there now for a bit more than 2 years, with I think more time during the pandemic than on site, which is interesting. And yeah, so the idea for us is to really create innovative AAA games. And so we shipped Squadrons last year. Was really, I think, really well received by the public, but also by the critics. It's the first game that we did fully inside, so fully fledged title that we did ourselves. And we announced this summer that we're working on Dead Space. That's really exciting. There are so many other things that are exciting about the studio. We're also expanding to Toronto and Quebec. So that's also part of the job that I'm doing right now, is making sure that, how do we do this? We're not just saying like, yeah, sure, let's go there. There is a plan behind it. That's pretty much it about Motive. I think for me, why did I choose Motive? It is when you do interviews, it's yes for them to judge you, but also for you to judge the company that you're joining. Sometimes we forget about this, but it's also for the candidate to judge the company. And I was impressed by the people that were in it. And that's why I chose to join this leadership team, because I felt that it's not just about the games and about the business. It's also about how we make sure that we as people and as human collectively work together so that we have something that is powerful at the end. Usually I think that once you see a game at the end, you will see that in the game, you have the soul of the team that worked on it. So sometimes you see that the game is missing some stuff. Maybe in the team, there were some silos, people not talking to each other. And usually behind a great game and something that is really, in terms of quality, but in terms of polish and in terms of how the features and everything work together, you're going to see that, okay, this is a team that knows how to work with each other. And that's always what I'm looking for when I work with people. It's the team and it's the people. So that's why also I think I not fell in love, but I was attracted to join Motive at that point.
I think that's really cool. I think it's a great reason to join a company. You're so right as well. You know, like when you're playing a game, I think it's becoming more and more apparent now, games which are made in good environments compared to those which aren't. What's it like on a day-to-day basis now within your role? Because you obviously you're head of operations at Reflektor, but now you're director of operations. And in EA Motive, obviously, Dead Space is a huge IP. Yeah. I'm personally not going to play it because I don't do well with scary games. But
you should see us playing the game. I mean, I was playing with my team and we're all scared. So my direct team operation, and I told them the day that I'm going to play test before it's out, I'm going to have all lights on. I won't be alone in my house. We're going to be close to me so that we all play together and I'm not alone playing this. But yeah, it would make good videos in terms of marketing, though. That would be fun.
Yeah, I bet. Like, I think I don't know why you'd want to be scared, right? Like, why do people want to be scared? I know so many people love scary games. They're so challenging. But what is it like on a day-to-day basis? Like, what are you doing? Is it just an expansion of your previous roles, or is there like unique elements within that?
So it's the big change versus production is that I'm not directly on the production teams. I'm more in the background. I see my role as a support role. So there are three main things that the way that I usually explain it is three main things in this order. So the first one is people, then project, and then budget. So my objective is to make sure that our employees, they're happy in what they're doing. They have a clear path in terms of development and growth. They can perform the way that they need to perform. And if they need to be difficult discussion, that they are happening so that everyone can grow. It's making sure also that they have, especially during the pandemic, they have everything that they need to be at home, that they're feeling good, and all the support that you can give to make sure that your employees are as performant as they can. Because ultimately, without them, we can't do anything. So then there is the project. So making sure that project management 101, like, are we hitting the milestones? Do we have any risk? How do we mitigate those risks, etc.? And then budget. I mean, we're a company, so we need to make sure that we have money and that we're making money. But that's everything is, I mean, without the money, I can't pay the employees. Without the employee, we can't do the project. And without the project, we can't have money. So it's everything is together. But the way that we really prioritize it is really people first on my team. So that's usually the way that operation works. We added on my side, because it's something that's really dear to my heart, is anything linked to outreach. So making sure that we're involved in the community and then we can give back, not only as a company, but as individuals and game developers, that we can help the community that we're in.
That's great. I think it's fantastic that you have that as a role. I think it's really, really cool. I think historically you hear about stories of big publishers being these big, bad companies. I think it's fantastic that you have this in your role to basically make sure people are happy, right?
It's also to make sure that people understand in the company how important it is. And that's the main thing. We're working right now on the clear strategy so that we can explain to everyone outside of Motiv. But the idea for me is that when I started, is like, we need to make sure that we're doing this internally before we go outside and give lessons to anyone else. The idea is to, let's do our homeworks, making sure that if we think that diversity is important, then we need to work on it internally. And then we'll be able to say, okay, we have this internally. We think that it's working. Let's see how we can talk with others and implement things outside so that it can actually work.
Is that something you eventually want to progress in? Like, because I feel like you've got a lot, and obviously we're going to talk soon about, you know, STEMist. But yeah, I mean, as a director of operations, do you want to focus on the diversity, the inclusion element as like a career path and role eventually where it encompasses everything you do? Or do you want to progress as a director of operations? And if so, what does that actually look like?
That's a good question. I think for me, it's more the operation part. I don't think we should separate the diversity and the outreach. It's something that is so part of me, so that whatever the role I'm going to have, this is going to be part of it. And I think that's the same way, I'm going to go into politics quickly, the same way I don't think environment should be a specific thing for a specific person to follow and a party to focus just on environment. It should be part of everyone's mindset. And we should have all the parties that we're voting on, whatever you prefer, liberal or conservative, they should have some environment part of it. So that's the same way for me. It's really to make sure that whatever your role in a company, you need to understand, and even as a human, if you're in your city, then you need to see how can I get involved in my city and in my community. So when I arrived, I moved a few months ago in a new city. I'm right next to Montreal. Once after a month and I settled everything, then I wrote to the town hall and I asked them, how can I get involved? How can I help and give back to my community? And I think that's something that we need to make sure. If you're going to have a great company, if people are involved and if themselves are also getting involved in improving things internally, and then ultimately, I hope, also externally and get involved through the company in their community. That's not something that for me would be a specialization. It's more something that we all need to have.
I think that's a great answer to my terrible question in terms of picking one or the other. do you, with the director of operations role, what is the career progression like for that specifically? Because once you almost hit like a director position, you know, you've got C-suite above you, you've obviously got senior directors and so on, but it sounds like your role is so broad and you encompass so much. How do you progress from here?
That's a good question. I just finished my dev plan that I talked with my manager last week. So that's a good question. I can't
answer. You're like, here's a PowerPoint I prepared earlier.
No, it's just because right now, I mean, ultimately my remit right now is just for Motiv and just for Montreal. So the simple fact that we're extending to Quebec and Toronto, for me, that's going to be a challenge to make sure that, how do we make sure that people that are many kilometers away, that they still feel included, that we're still working as one team throughout those three locations. And then ultimately, if I look really long term, maybe it could be whole Canada and then the whole company. And then one day I'm going to take Laura's mini position.
Okay. Fantastic. I'm glad you've got your career path.
I mean, maybe one day I'll just gonna stop and do something else and just go on an island. And I don't know. But...
run an island? Okay. Okay. Well, let me know how that goes because
I'll invite you and your team. You.
Talk to me about, because you're a STEMinist.
Right? I am a STEMinist.
And this is a new term because I've been doing research and I think it's a fantastic term. But could you explain it to everybody listening? Like, what is a STEMinist?
Yeah. So in STEMinist, you have STEM. So you have STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And the idea for a STEMinist, it's someone that advocates for equal representation in all social groups for STEM.
It's brilliant. How can the games industry create positive, consistent change when it comes to diversity and inclusion? And I suppose the key word there is consistent, like consistent change.
So I think there are two parts of your question. The first part is really linked to the game industry. I think everyone should be involved. It's not just... Yes, it always starts from the top for sure. So the e-suits of any company should really be involved in this and making changes around this. But everyone should be involved, whatever your role, whatever your level. Did you just join the industry? Are you looking at joining the industry? You should all get involved and understand all the realities and all the pain points that we have right now so that we can all work together. So even if you're not part of a underrepresented talent pool, then you can see how can I be an ally to those underrepresented talents so that we can grow together. We're starting to get there, well, together. We're starting to have some momentum and some traction, and we see more women represented in games and in STEM in general. When I saw all the people that interviews, you have quite a few women, so I was like, yeah, good, thanks. Yeah. We need to put more people, I think, in front of media and examples and not just always the same person. There are so many different diverse talent, and I'm just not talking about women here, but there are so many people with diverse background that we can be inspired from. And there are so many different jobs and roles in video game industry that it's actually easy to find people to interview and to put forward so that they can inspire others. Sometimes people are scared. I think that the whole Me Too movement helped us reach another level in terms of everyone being aware of the real problem. But I think we should not scare also young people because sometimes they're like, oh, that's a male-dominated industry. Should I really join that industry because I'm going to be alone? I'm like, yeah, we should. Yes, there is not enough women, but let's stop putting emphasis on it's a male-dominated industry and let's put emphasis on you have your place and there are efforts being done. And I mean, ultimately, whatever the industry you're going to join, there are going to be problems because it's a question of culture. And I think that's the second part of my answer. It's not just the game industry that needs to be involved in this. It's everyone, whatever your industry. If your parents are not setting the example, if your school or your teachers are not setting the example, then that would be difficult for people to think that they can actually reach whatever they want to. And the same way that there is no men job, there is no woman job. So if you want to be working, delivering babies, then you don't need to be a woman. You can be a guy also delivering babies. So that's... And it takes time. Changing culture takes so much time. But I think everyone should be involved. And if I didn't have a family that was so supportive, and I remember we used to play games together when we were young. So I think that also helped me understand that it's not just a thing for my brother. It's also something that I can do, actually.
I think sometimes, I suppose, because this is a podcast for the games industry, we do focus on diversity within the games industry. I think obviously it's because we consume a lot of media. Well, I consume a lot of media from games media, right? It can give you quite a siloed look on, oh, this is just the games industry, but you're completely right. It's actually, there is a massive lack of equality just in general in society. I find it incredibly frustrating that we can't just talk about people's merits and that can't be the focus of like why someone should be good for a role. And I think with like the Game Dev Show, it's like, yeah, we go through a process of identifying individuals based on their profile and their careers. And it's never, ever about, you know, gender. It's never, ever about race. It's always about the individual. And I think like we've still had a lot more men on the show, but we have had a lot of women. And that is just down to the merit of those women who have been on the show. It's nothing else other than that.
I mean, it's difficult also to change a culture because we can't go from years and years of not saying anything and then starting the Me Too movement and then expecting that everything will change from one day to another without explaining to people, you know, what you've been doing for quite a few years now, that's actually not okay. So it's also for I think on everyone, once again, to be able to explain it. So no, this is where the mid is now. If you need more information, if you need trainings, and that's something that I really like at EA and Motive, is that everyone is being trained on what is inclusion. Why do we need diversity? And to the higher level, and I see that with Patrick, so my boss and the GM of the studio, is I'm impressed with the way that he's challenging himself. Every time he's telling me, if you feel that I'm taking too much space, let me know. If you think that here this I have a bias because I am a man, then let me know. And we have interesting conversation because I know that there is trust, and I can tell him, well, here actually this is the way that I perceive it, and maybe it's a woman thing, I don't know, but let's talk about it. And having more people like him, I think, would really help us to switch this culture. But once again, it's going to take time. And I think it's already better because I remember when I was young, if you ask my family who between my brother and I would end up in video games, they would 100% say my brother. And I think now if you ask a family who has a girl and a boy, maybe they will say, oh, well, you know what? We're not sure. I really hope actually that it's that. And if not, then let's work on making this happen.
I think it's great that it's part of your role. Another good thing about EA and EA Motive. Talking of acceptance, but in a bit more of a playful way, I saw a picture on Twitter, your Twitter, and you're wearing a t-shirt, says, "Geek is the new sexy." So I love this. I think this is fantastic. And if I could pull it off, I would definitely wear one. When do you think gamers just became more acceptable? Like, when do you think it became cool, you know?
And so it would be through time. It's an industry that is still quite young if you compare to movies or any other industry. So when our parents started, even with my parents' generation, they started seeing games coming, but they didn't necessarily understand what it was. It was still new for them. So it was still a bit weird for people to play games because there were so few people playing it that they didn't understand it. They were like, "Yeah, I'm not sure." And one of the first questions that I got when I started working in the industry, my mom was like, "Is there any future in video games?" And I think now, because now the people that we grew up and we're becoming parents with our age, we grew up with video games. So for us, it's normal and it's acceptable, even though they're still part of the humanity that haven't experienced games. I think we're going to have more people, more and more people. And the way that before it was just on console and it was really limited in terms of number of people, now you have phones. You have console that you can, yes, you can go on really specific console with the PlayStation and the Xbox, but then you have Nintendo that is doing different kind of games for different kind also of maybe people. And I think it's more reachable. My mom is playing, my dad is playing, everyone is playing. So I think that they also understand more. I think people understand more and more this industry, not enough, to be honest, but I think it's because everyone is touching games. And even if they don't think that they're, I'm not playing the big AAA, it just went out. You're playing Candy Crush on your phone. You're playing video games. So that's, it's more known now. So is it cooler? I don't know. Big Bang Theory also helped us in terms of nerd and geek. I love this t-shirt now.
It is a fantastic t-shirt. What are your parents playing at the moment?
My dad used to play a lot and too much of Sorcery on Amstrad when I was born. And then my mom was like, we need a life also. I remember when we were, my dad was a military, so we used to move often. And every time we were on holidays in the car, we had two Game Boys with the cable between them and we were playing Tetris.
Oh, great.
Dating us. She was so good at Tetris.
Really?
And my brother always played video game. I was not allowed to touch his console, but when he was not there, I was definitely playing something.
Right. You should get your mom on the Tetris Connect. It's so good.
She's playing a lot of Candy Crush now. Maybe.
Is she? Yeah. Oh, it's obviously, we're coming to the end of the show slowly, but I love that one of your themes really is like this approach to just making things better, culturally. You know, obviously you want to create fantastic games, you want to be involved in game development, and you can really feel that obviously speaking to you. I think the more overriding theme is definitely that improvement of people and process at the same time. Because I know you do a lot of volunteer work as well and with different causes, and I thought it was very extremely great and interesting. Your work at, is it Kid Code? Jeunesse?
Kids Coding or Kids Code Jeunesse, yes. And there is also something else I'm part of is Technovation. For me, it's really, we have a lot of work to do inside the industry for people that are already in the industry, but there is also all those young people that they need to understand what is actually video games, and that's showing them that it's actually interesting and not that difficult. There was a study, I think, done a few years ago, almost 10 years ago, that asked themselves, why are girls not considering any career in STEM? And that was mainly because they don't have examples of successful women in this. So we're getting more and more examples of women having interesting careers, and not just, careers and family and a balanced life with everything else. So that's already a good improvement. But the other thing that they mentioned is that they don't have the opportunity to test and to try, because most of the time when we think, oh, there is a programming session, and then the parents by default will think, oh, I'm going to bring my boy to this session. I'm like, yeah, no, maybe your girl will also be interested in this. And then when they actually tried, and we saw when we were with Kid Genesis, and we told them, you know what, bring both your kids, and you're going to see that your girl is actually going to be also interested. And they were. But it's also, so they want to try, but they want to try sometimes when you reach the teenage age, they want to try just between them, not to be judged by other boys, especially we all know at that time that girls and boys sometimes are just an awkward interaction. So that's also why we have, so Technovation, I think it was actually created in the US. And the idea is that we have a few months for a group of girls, they will think of a problem in their community. And then we'll bring them to think of a mobile application that will help their community on this problem. So it could be either a simple app, or it could go up through games. Last session, I think, was in the winter. The three girls that we mentored, they were actually doing a game about the environment and the way that the technological waste is impacting our environment. And we need to be conscious about this. And it's really interesting because they were not necessarily considering career in video games before we started. They liked video games. And then we took the time to explain to them, so this is how an engine works. Also managed to reach out to some colleagues that made themselves available on weekends or night to explain to them, okay, so I'm a game designer, this is what I do, etc. So they got, I guess, a privileged course on here are different roles that you have in video games, and here is someone that is actually working in video games, and they could ask all their questions. And now two out of the three are still asking questions. And, oh, I'm working in Unity on this, and I'm trying to code this. I'm like, yes.
That's so good. That's great. You must love that. You must love hearing, getting those questions still now. Like, how can the games industry as a whole, like, how can that contribute more to these, like, positive causes? Because there's a lot of money in the games industry, like a ridiculous amount of money now. And there's a lot of investment going on in the games industry. And I think it's like, you spoke earlier about obviously, like, you know, the environment and everybody taking the environment seriously. And I just think there's this window where as a industry, we should be doing more to improve, like, not just obviously the environment, but just more towards positive causes. How would that work?
So looking at for sure young kids to spark an interest early enough, and then making sure that they have the opportunity to join whenever they want and be able to try anything. So programs like Kids Code Jeunesse, we also have something in Montreal called the Code Montréal. And the idea is really that they're also investing in teachers to make sure that teachers understand how to code, at least the basics, so they understand also what's so important in the mindset of coding, so that, I mean, ultimately, I think it should be a requirement, and we should review and add a class of coding, I think, since we're really young, because it helps you also see, it switches your mindset in terms of logics and way to see things. So I think we should get involved more in terms of education, for sure, so that we have those kids who were born with an iPhone or whatever in their hands, they know technology. And I think that investing in them, that will definitely bring us way more than we think of, and way more diversity if we manage to get them early enough so that they actually stay, go study. Because right now the main problem that we have is that even if we want to have more women, there are not enough that are graduating from universities in computer science or even in tech programs. So if we start early enough, then they will reach those universities. If we make sure that they're supported during their years of university, they will stay at university, they will graduate, and then we'll get them. So I think investing in youth is actually the way to go. It's one of the way to go. It's not the only one, though.
I think you're completely right. I think there's going to be a greater and greater emphasis on educating at a younger and younger point, so we can change the stereotype that the games industry is more for just men and actually open up the talent pool. Last question. But this has been fantastic. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Could you summarize your career? Like, if you're going to summarize your career in games so far in, say, one or two sentences, what would that summary be?
My summary would be, it's just the beginning. So it's almost 10 years on the AAA side, production side of things. And now I'm more into the operations of the studio and the behind the curtains, making sure that everything is happening and is in place for production teams to shine.
Brilliant. Amber, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Merci. Joining me on the Game Dev Show. Merci. I know very little French. I know ça va, très bien. Thank you so much. Just a quick note that the opinions that you've heard today are Amber's and my own and do not reflect our employers. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can do at thegamedevshow@ptw.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Luke. Thank you.